Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Wednesday, March 27th. I'm Ray Graff. It's getting to be that time. Tax time. Ah, that's great. That's just one. On today's program, we get some tax advice from two folks at BST, an accounting, tax, and financial services consulting firm. Judy Cahey is here, and Dawn Doherty is here. They are here to help you answer your tax questions. 800-348-2551 is the number. 800-348-2551. You can also email us if you wish. voxpop@wamc.org is the email. voxpop@wamc.org. And again, the number is 800-348-2551. Judy Cahey, Dawn Doherty, and your tax and finance calls coming up after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. On today's show, we get some tax tips and financial advice from BST, an accounting, tax, and financial services consulting firm. Judy Cahey has decades of tax experience and extensive knowledge in the areas of individual, corporate, partnership, and estate and trust taxation. Judy has a bachelor's in accounting from Castleton State College and a master's in taxation from UAlbany. Dawn Doherty is a certified public accountant and tax partner at BST. She has over 35 years of accounting and tax experience, providing tax consultation, planning, compliance, and tax accounting services, in addition to tax controversy services to a wide array of privately held, family-owned, and publicly traded businesses, as well as individuals. Dawn started her career with the IRS. If you have a question, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. 2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Dawn Doherty, Judy Cahey, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Ray.
Thanks for having us.
And you said before the show that it's been pretty low-key this season. That's
it's
good, yeah?
It's a little bit low-key. We're watching Senate. There's a bill that's been kicking around. The House passed it in January. Some of it may be retroactive, like a change to the child tax credit, but it's stalled, and here we sit.
You know, those retroactive deals really are confusing. A couple few years back, I think it was during the pandemic, they really expanded some of these energy credits when you did, you know, work on your house to make it more energy efficient. You know, we, of course, did ours right before it all happened. But some of it is still carrying over, right?
Yeah. The difficult part for the administration, the administration side, is that the changes get made by Congress, and then it's up to the taxing agencies to update their systems on time to help taxpayers comply. So that very often is the challenge. But the commissioner of the IRS has assured the public that that the changes that are proposed in this current legislation that's hasn't yet made it to the Senate floor, that they're poised to take care of at least the individual income tax provisions, and that is with the mostly with the child tax credit.
You know, it seems to me that whatever efficiency, and I know you worked at the IRS, don't take offense.
I won't.
But I mean, whatever efficiency the government might have was blown out of the water because of the pandemic, and people tried filing and they waited and waited. You couldn't get through to anybody. Is it clearing up now?
It is finally. We're finding that what was sometimes a 90-minute wait on hold has significantly shortened to a 15-minute hold or a 30-minute hold, depending on the nature of the inquiries that we make. But for the most part, you know, the government was inundated with a number of filings. When you think about all of the pandemic provisions that came through, both in the Families First Act as well as the CARES Act, the Coronavirus Act, that brought a lot of tax credits. So there were millions of filings. So it really challenged the tax agency.
You know, Dawn, by 2021, by tax filing 2021, the pandemic was in full disgusting flower. And I just saw an article, I think it came out yesterday or Monday on the IRS website, time running out to claim $1 billion in refunds from tax year 2020. There's a May 17th deadline. Is $1 billion, is that excessive or is that about right, about normal?
I couldn't comment on that.
I'm sure that their estimate is based upon, it is most likely based upon withholdings that are available and already filed by employers. So when you do the math that shows, here's what the wages were for our employees, here are the withholdings, we would therefore expect a refund of whatever X dollars to be available. And without that filing, those refunds can't be issued.
There's a May 17th deadline to file for the tax year 2020, this has just surprised the daylights out of me, but it's really not that surprising. If you don't file within 3 years, then the Treasury gets the
correct
refund.
It's 3-year statute of limitations. And right. 2020 tax year was due May 15th. That was the oddball year where instead of April, it ended up being May 15th, and thus we get to May of this year, closing down that 3-year window.
Does that seem right to you? I mean, why should they take the money?
Well, it's statutory. It was written by Congress that way for a reason.
I didn't really ask that.
Yes, I know. Whether or not it's right. No. But, you know, just like every type of claim, there is a statute of limitations for taxpayers taking action. It's their money. If you'd like it back, you need to take action by a certain date. Because if you think about it administratively, if it was permanently open, that would just be nearly impossible to track going back to the beginning of time.
Or the Republic. I mean, it's not that long, but okay, fair enough. When did they actually start income tax? Was it in the 20s?
Oh, no. I want to say it was earlier than that. The tax law that preceded the 86 Act was 1959. And what was the first date, Judy?
1913.
A fine year. Well, you know, they're, according to the IRS, and this is from their website, all their bulletins, the average median refund for 2020 was $932, which ain't hay. And I did some, there's a table, and I did some quick calculations between New York, Massachusetts, Connecticut, New Hampshire, and Vermont, basically our main listening states, almost 90,000 refunds to be claimed. So,
right.
You know, you might want to file. But don't you, if you owe, then you're in trouble because you owe all that penalty and interest. Yeah.
There's zero statute of limitations if you have not filed.
Okay, that's ridiculous. Fair is fair. Should be 3 years.
3 years from when
you can't get your refund after 3 years, you shouldn't have to pay them. Am I wrong?
Well, part of our compliance system.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. Well, let's go to the phones now. 800-348-2551 is our number. I'll tell you what, let's grab an email or two first, then we'll take a break, then we'll hit the phones. This is from, I don't know who it's from. Is it true that relinquishing citizenship will save me on my taxes? There are many videos on social media about this, but the concept seems far-fetched.
Okay. So, first of all, in order to relinquish your citizenship, you actually have to file your final returns with the Internal Revenue Service and essentially be issued an all-clear pass. So, if you're going to permanently relinquish your citizenship, sure, you're welcome to do that if you'd like to leave the United States. If you want to kind of straddle more than one country, expect to be taxed here in the U.S.
What? She says that with a smile, Judy. I don't know. Is that disconcerting to you?
No.
All right, fair enough. Judy Cahey and Dawn Doherty join us from BST, Accounting, Tax, and Financial Services. This is from Mark. I'll be turning 73 the first week of December 2024. Mark is in Schenectady. What is the calculation or formula to determine my required distribution for 2024?
So the IRS publishes a table based upon your year of birth, and the calculation is based upon 1231 of the previous tax year. So for example, if I was 75 this year, my RMD for 2024 would be based on the 12/31/2023 value multiplied by a table that the IRS publishes with the life expectancy based upon your year of birth. So there's a calculation to it.
Okay. Let's see. We'll go to Jamie, who writes, my fiance and I are getting married this year. He works for himself, and I have a public sector job. We're in our 50s. He owns our own, and he owns our own home. Should we file jointly or separately? And that's from Jamie.
That's a good question. And very often that comes down to, number one, do both parties want to be responsible for the whole tax liability? That should be question number one. Generally speaking, joint filing does provide for a lower overall tax. What normally are credits or tables aren't split evenly down the middle when you come to a married filing separate status. So it very often, from a pure tax paid or rate of tax, typically joint works out better. Now, if one party has an outside business and the spouse does not want to ever be liable for the tax on that joint return at any moment in time, then perhaps a separate filing might be the better way to go.
And I'll say that another way. So it's rare that it's advantageous to file a married filing separate return. It can happen, but it's not very common. And in fact, it can hurt you other ways. Like if you do a Roth IRA contribution every year because your income is under that threshold as a separate taxpayer, when you file married filing separately, your phase out's 10 grand of income. So all of a sudden you find yourself in a situation where you can't do a Roth where you have before. So it's generally not advantageous, but the accountant can run the numbers and tell you the math on.
Interesting. So, you know. I mean, for years I would hear, oh, the marriage penalty, this and that. So really there's no marriage penalty, or was there at one time with taxation?
There was at one time, I would say, the single rates and what was available to single taxpayers may have been more advantageous. But now that's not really generally our observation.
The brackets follow. So, yeah. You know.
Okay. Let's take a break. 800-348-2551. We're already kicking it into high gear here. Judy Cahey, Dawn Doherty from BST. We'll be back with your calls at 800-348-2551. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you. It's tax time, and we have some pros here to give you some tips. Dawn Doherty and Judy Cahey from BST are with us. The number is 800-348-2551. And let's jump to the phones. We'll go to Albany. John, you're on.
Hello, Ray.
Hello. You're on.
Hello. Love the show.
Thanks.
Sorry about that. My phone switched between speaker. I was trying to get you off speaker.
Oh, I appreciate that.
Started a new business. I'm good at what I do, but not staying on top of taxes. I didn't file quarterly taxes, which I now know I should have been doing. And I'm just trying to see what the best course of action is.
Is this a pass-through entity? What kind of entity do you own?
An LLC. I'm a sole owner.
Okay. Tax day is 2.5 weeks away. In general, with respect specifically to income taxes, right? Your question's on income tax and not on payroll or any other quarterlies, right? You don't have any employees.
No, it would be directly related. Okay. Yeah, no employees.
So statutorily, you know, in order to you need to do the lesser of two things, and it depends on your overall gross income. But in concept, IRS, if your gross income is more than $150,000, they want you paying based upon the lesser of 110% of your 22 numbers or 90% of your 2023 numbers. So I'm assuming this is a 2023 question, right? You started a business in 2023.
Correct.
Yeah. So you may be okay if you're safe harbor, but you have to do the math on that. So in other words, you know, you take your 2022 tax and you either have to pay 100% of it if your gross income was like less than 150 and you're married, or 110% to safe harbor yourself on that, but or 90% of the 23 tax, which I'm expecting to be more. So it's math, but there it depends on your withholding as well.
Okay, and that would be for the business entity itself?
So a single member LLC, absent you making an election to be taxed as a corporation, should just be reportable on your Schedule C on your individual return. It gets baked in there.
Okay.
I got you. I'm new to this, so I appreciate it. Thank you.
Hey, good luck. Thanks for the call. 800-348-2551. Don Daugherty and Judy Cahy join us every so often on this program, usually around tax time and toward the end of the year. Judy, just a personal question. Mm-hmm. You're always good in math, yeah?
Well, a lot of this rests on math, right? So we get very technical questions, and they're looking, you know, we deal in a very technical area, and the questions are very specific. But yes, I
so
like math.
Good. Yeah,
I like math.
When did you know you wanted to do this?
In college, right? So you start out in an accounting program, and you take a accounting one and accounting two, and you start doing bond accounting. I'm like, well, that's not for me. And I ended up taking a tax class my sophomore year of college, and I liked law. I liked the theory. And tax is a little blend of both, numbers and law. So that's what caught my interest.
If you get the numbers wrong, you'll be dealing with the law.
So right. That's right.
What about you, Dawn?
I actually did not start in accounting. I started my career working for the taxing agency that you mentioned earlier.
Yes.
Yeah. So and then went into accounting from there. And just really found it. I think Judy kind of hit on the unique nature of practicing tax, that it's quasi accounting and quasi law, because we are working with the tax law. We're not lawyers, but we work with the tax law. So it makes it forever interesting with all of the changes that that are constantly coming our way.
So you were not a numbers person at the IRS.
Were you the muscle? In a different way. I did actually start in collections. That is where I started my career, was in collections.
And how did that work out for you? Did you like it?
It was interesting, that's for sure. You learn a lot about the process. That is one real advantage, I can say, for having worked for the Internal Revenue Service, is you understand how the processes work and how each function really supports the overall tax administration.
I knew I remembered your voice. I knew it. All right, let's go back to the phones. Justin in North Adams. Justin, you're on.
Hey, thank you so much for taking my call. I'm really glad that y'all are good with the numbers. I'm a social studies guy, not a math guy. So hopefully you can kind of help me get a little bit of guidance. So, hey, I actually, for 2023, I was out of work for about 2 months with FML, family medical leave. Mm-hmm. And in Massachusetts, we have the paid family medical leave. So the state pays you for the time that you're off. However, they disclose when you file your application, as of November, I'm reading this verbatim, as of November 23rd, the IRS has not yet made a ruling on whether your PFML benefits are considered taxable income. Massachusetts tax treatment will follow the guidance provided by the IRS. So here I am filing my taxes in 2024, and I got a notary that says that I need to, claim my PFML time, yet the state is sort of kind of wishy-washy about whether or not it needs to be claimed. And for me, if I do claim the PFML time, that's $3,000 that I owe to Mass. If I don't claim it, I'm actually getting a little bit of a refund. So I'm kind of wondering if you have any information about guidance on PFML and the way that the IRS stands with that.
I have not encountered this question before, Justin. at this moment, I would say if you want to be cautious, then include it. You'll always avoid penalties, as horrible as it is to actually part with the cash, if in fact there's a different position taken on it by the IRS and the state follows that position, then you'd get your money back. But I would be fearful that you would be stuck with an even bigger bill later on for not including something that should have been included in your taxable income. Then you owe penalties plus interest and all of that. So
yeah, and I'm looking at the Massachusetts website, and it exactly what you're saying. It's still saying that the IRS you know, it's dated, you know, as of November 23rd, the IRS has still not made a final ruling. So I think...
When are they going to do it?
Right? I don't know.
Yeah, it's really a determination.
They're answering the phone, Ray.
There's an entire internet community right now revolving around the whole question about mass PFML and whether or not do I pay it, do I not pay it?
Right.
When I heard y'all were on the air, I thought, hey, I'm going to call, maybe talk to somebody who may know.
Yeah, my thought is that the confusion is, or at least the debate on the IRS side, is likely whether or not it's deemed to be sick pay and perhaps excludable under that provision. But if this really was not sick pay, then it really wouldn't fall statutorily into that bucket of income. So that's my thought on relative to...
If it's family medical leave, it's equivalent to sick pay, yeah?
Not necessarily, because sick pay really is for the individual who is sick. If you'll recall, family medical leave, you can take that for a variety of reasons.
All right, Justin, hey, good luck, man. Let us know what happens. 800-348-2551 is our number. Tax time and financial help from, well, not help, but certainly advice from Don Daugherty and Judy Cahey. And let's see, we'll go to Joan in Schenectady. Hello, Joan in Schenectady. How are you?
I'm well. Can you hear me?
Very well. Hit it.
Okay, good, because I'm so sorry. You are on speakerphone, I think. Still learning my new phone, right?
You're on speakerphone right now? Oh, boy, Joan, you're fancy.
I think I am. I can't get back to the screen where I could check. So don't worry about it. If you can hear me.
Yeah, pretty good. Go ahead.
You can hear me. I can hear you. We're happy. I have a question for our tax experts. Because of a disability determination a few years back, and then finally aging into what would be considered early retirement age, I don't have to file taxes federally, well below the cutoff limit. So I haven't been filing any taxes. It's been a joy not to file taxes. But am I losing out on any state or possibly federal tax credits that I don't get back that I am entitled to, mm-hmm. even though I'm not required to pay taxes at this point? Income taxes.
I'm trying to think. Yeah, on the federal front, there's credits up for, you know, doing things like energy efficient improvements to your house, but those are non-refundable. Many of the credits are not refundable. And on the state side, I'm trying to think if there's anything...
That are refundable credits.
That are refundable, but you'd pay a preparer more to do a return to get a $50 refundable credit than
it might be worth.
Sure. Now,
absolutely.
If there was something that used to be the real property tax credit for renters,
if for New York State purposes,
New York State only. Yeah.
I recall that credit myself. You are a renter, I presume?
I rent, yeah, and okay. I may be paying a low enough amount that I qualify.
I don't know that that one is, in fact, refundable. So the difference being a credit that's non-refundable would only offset a tax liability.
There's a real property credit for renters in New York. Refundable if your gross income is under 18 grand and your average monthly rent was 450 or less. So there's criteria on the New York State website for that credit, but it is refundable, but there
is
very
refundable.
Strict criteria to get there.
I couldn't recall if it was refundable.
Okay,
or not.
So if I think I meet
if you're under 65, it can be
it
up to
be
$75.
Say it again.
If you're
Judy?
Under 65, it can be up to $75. If you're over 65, it can be as much as $375. So it exists. You'd have to see.
Okay.
All right, Joan, good luck. Thanks for the call. 800-348-2551. Taxes and finances with Judy Cahey and Don Daugherty from BST today. And we'll see here. Let's go to Saratoga. Alan, you're on.
Oh, good afternoon. How are you?
Yeah, doing all right. How are you?
Excellent. Thank you. Hey, my question has to do with filing a tax return for an LLC that I created in probably November of 2023. If I didn't do any business under that LLC, do I still have to file a tax return for the year 2023?
And who owns the LLC? Is it just you, Alan?
Yes.
Okay. So if you had no business conducted, then generally speaking, you wouldn't have something specific to the LLC unless you had other sources of income that would put you at the filing threshold. So did you have other activity that would put you at the filing threshold?
Well, yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah. I have other income.
Okay.
But
okay.
LLC, do I have to file a tax return in 2023 for that LLC? If there was no business conducted under that business yet?
No, generally speaking, there is a separate filing that is made for New York State LLCs or businesses that are not New York State LLCs but doing business in the state. So when you do start having activity in that LLC, then you will be required to file an IT-204 LL form, and it's an LLC fee. That is based on the level of activity in that LLC. So perhaps not for 2023. That due date would have been March 15th anyway. So you would have missed the due date had you had activity in your LLC. So keep that in mind for this year, for 2024, and put it on your calendar that you will need to file your IT-204 LL by March 15th. Of 2025 for your 2024 activity and get that filed.
Got you.
So don't miss that filing. Of course.
Go ahead, Alan.
Follow-up question would be, do you have to have an accountant file the tax return for you if you have an LLC or a corporation like a S corp or a C corp? Does it?
Well, that's different questions. If you have a single member LLC and you just created as that and haven't made any special elections with the IRS, that gets baked into your Schedule C on your 1040. So from a reporting standpoint, it ends up on your 1040 as a single member LLC. If you have an S corp, that's a different answer because S corps are pass through entities. They file a form 1120S with the IRS and an equivalent to New York, and you know then yes, you're in accountant territory to complete that. But a Schedule C isn't terrible to report, but you have to have good accounting on it.
All right, Alan, thanks a lot. 800-348-2551. Let's do a couple of emails here, and then we'll take a break. This one's from David. Do you need to pay capital gains tax on the sale of your primary home? Is there a time limit by which you need to reinvest in another home in order to avoid capital gains tax?
You want it? It's a 121 exclusion. Yeah. So when I first started, as you said, decades ago, thanks for
that
intro,
right? That's what it says in the script.
Thanks for that. There used to be a rule that if you sold your home, you had to reinvest, and then Section 121 got changed. Right. So as a married filing joint taxpayer, you can exclude up to $500,000 of gains, $250,000 if you're single, capital gains on that primary residence. No previous home office use, no depreciation, no part rental, just pure primary residence.
And there are limits in how often you can go to the well with that.
Yeah. 2 out of 5 years you have to use it. So,
you know, I want to be clear. It's well known that you started in tax at age 6. So, I mean, come on. All right, let's see. This is from Mike in Malta. My wife inherited a pile of unclaimed property in Louisiana from her deceased uncle in 2022. This year, she received 5 1099 DIVs from Louisiana, unclaimed property totaling roughly $1,500 for ordinary dividends. This is inheritance, so should not be taxed. What should she do with these?
Well, what did she really inherit? If she inherited the property, that part isn't taxable. But the income that is derived from inherited property is not automatically exempt from taxation. So if the property underlying the dividends was inherited. Again, she would get the stepped up basis, whatever the value of that property was at the time of inheritance, but the income generated thereafter, that's hers.
Yeah, and that's an important point. So when you know, New York State has a website. I know this, we're talking Louisiana, but there's a massive amount of money sitting in unclaimed property in the state. And when you go there, right, so if a payor for these dividends couldn't find the person she inherited from, they get remitted to the state. And so right now, New York has $18 billion sitting in unclaimed funds. You can go out. But what they're doing is, because the person couldn't cash the dividend check and they couldn't locate them, they remit that into the state for unclaimed by the state law. And then she's picking up where her relative didn't report the type of income that they're passing to her. Ah. So there's two buckets to it. One is the security itself. The other is the dividend that on the income of it.
Okay. Maybe it's time to call an accountant because I barely followed anything you just said. This is from John, and then we'll take a break. My wife and I gross about $120K. We have a few deductions, mortgage and student loan interest, but we also have about $5,000 in unreimbursed medical expenses, mostly dental. Is it worth itemizing? And that's from John in Poughkeepsie.
So the short answer is probably not. So a married filing joint 2023 standard deduction is about $27,700. In order to claim medical, you only get to claim it to the extent it exceeds 7.5% of your income. So he said 120 grand is his gross income. You multiply that by 7.5%, you're not going to get there on medical. Mm-hmm. And you're capped on taxes at 10 grand, you know, a little bit of mortgage interest. But as we've talked about in prior shows, you know, something like 70% of America files a standard deduction now after Tax Cuts and Jobs Act.
Yeah, now, it's been a few years since that happened, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
How do you feel about it now?
It goes away. So we revert to the old rules in 2026.
Is that good for most people who own homes in New York State?
In New York, I would say that generally will be true, that it will be more beneficial for people living in high tax states because they will, again, obtain those deductions. They won't be limited by that $10,000 cap.
Yeah, so two things happened with Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that were big. One is it changed fundamentals, like, okay, you're now capped at 10 grand of state tax. The other is rates, though, Ray. Yeah. So the 39.6 top rate dropped to 37. So they ended, you know, standard deduction or dependency exemptions for your children. And it really depends on your fact pattern to say, am I better off with Tax Cuts and Jobs Act or not? And it just, there's a lot of variables there.
Yeah. Fun. Let's take a break. 800-348-2551 is the number. Dawn Daugherty and Judy Cahey here from BST. We'll be back. Vox Pop on WAMC. It's tax time. Oh, yeah, that's great news. Dawn Daugherty and Judy Cahey are here, and they love this time of year. They're from BST, an accounting, tax, and financial services consulting firm. If you have a question, our number is 800-348-2551. It's all gobbledygook to me. So let's go to Whitesboro. Rich, you're on.
Oh, okay. Thanks for taking the call, Ray and guests.
Hi.
I have a question about... basis on a house. My name was put on a 15-year-old house added to the ownership, and the ownership was based on who died first. My sister passed away first a year ago, and so I took over full ownership. The inheritance went to me. And my question is, how would you figure the basis on that?
Can you tell us a little bit about how you acquired the interest on the deed to begin with, Rich?
My relative, it's my sister. She put name on the house.
I see. Okay. So at that moment in time.
Right. So if she put, so just to clarify, because this is important. So if she gifted you a 1/2 interest in the house, right? then theoretically you would have gotten one half of her basis at that time.
Correct.
If you then inherited one half from her upon her death, then theoretically you'd have a step up to the date of one death half. With appraisal. I think it depends too on whether it's like tenants in common or how
correct.
The deed
it
is
sounds
titled.
Like it was tenants with right of survivorship. Generally, though, you know, joint tenants with right of survivorship, I thought in New York State anyway, it was reserved only for spouses. But it could be that your agreement with your, I could be wrong about that. That's a legal item.
Yeah.
Nonetheless, it sounds like your sister's basis at the time she transferred to you, that would start your basis. And then at the time of her passing, then the one half of the value, because you already owned one half, so her half of the value
right.
would transfer to you at that time. Uh-huh. So that would be your basis really requires two separate pieces to calculate that. Yeah. I hope that helps.
Yeah, the way it would have worked is if I had died first, it would have gone to her estate.
Right.
Yeah, tenants in common.
Yes, tenants in common. Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Rich. Appreciate the call.
Okay. Yeah, thank you.
Yep. Gwen writes in from New York City. I prepare my own return and last year began paying estimated taxes quarterly. The last payment for 23 was made January 15th, 2024.
Mm-hmm.
Do I claim this January payment on my 23 return or my 24 return?
You will claim that one on your 23 return. January 15th is the last day to pay estimates with respect to 2023.
Okay, fair enough. Let's go back to our phone lines. Dean is in Springfield, Mass. Dean, you're on.
Thank you for taking my call. My wife and I make about $140,000 collectively. We have two children. Our oldest daughter turning 17, child tax credit dropped from $1,500 to $500, and we missed our tax bracket by about $900, and as such, owe about $1,000. Is there any way to reduce our taxable income?
After the fact, kind of difficult to do, and unless, of course, you still have wiggle room to maybe make a retirement contribution.
Are you both covered by a employer's
employer plan?
A plan on a retirement.
My wife contributes to an IRA, but we were told we made too much money claim it. And I contribute 12% weekly to a 403, 12% per paycheck to a 403B.
Okay.
So you're an employer plan. Yeah.
So that'll limit you significantly. I mean, normally we would recommend that when individuals are looking for another deduction, that's a way to do it if you're eligible. But it sounds like that is not an option for you. I can't think of
other things. In arrears.
It is, unfortunately.
Hey, Dean, you know, it's a bummer that you're in the higher tax bracket, but I'll tell you, you have a bigger problem. Your daughter's 17. So good luck, man. I'll tell you that from experience. Thanks for the call. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. And Elizabeth's in Albany. Elizabeth, you're on.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
I have an inherited IRA, and I have got 1099-Rs that I'm having a hard time finding out where to enter certain amounts of funds that are in different boxes. I'm doing my taxes on TurboTax, and I don't want to make any double entries.
Sure.
And I'm wondering if when the gross amount in the inherited IRA was transferred from one brokerage house to a new one, the one I'm using now, was that one sum? And then the recommended minimal distributions is another fund that are both 1099-Rs.
Okay.
And is one reportable and one not reportable or taxable or not taxable?
So the boxes of your 1099-R show some numeric information about taxability or non-taxable, or sometimes a box is checked taxability not determined. So you got to double check the 1099-R presentation as to what it's indicating about the taxability. Sometimes it doesn't necessarily tell the full picture of reporting. There's times that it just doesn't, it doesn't reflect the qualified charitable distribution or other things people have going on. But ultimately, to the extent it's taxable, it needs to land on 4B on your 1040 as a taxable IRA.
Well, both the forms have 2B checked, taxable amount not determined.
Right, right. That's not all that surprising. Right. Maybe if you reach out to the brokerage house that's handling these IRAs, they can give you more information about the individual who this IRA came from. Inherited IRAs are a little more tricky than a regular IRA that someone routinely contributes to, and then ultimately end up taking benefits from.
And the other thing to keep in mind on this is that, Elizabeth, when you do your New York State return, to the extent, I don't know your facts here in general and you don't have to share with me, but there is such a thing as a pension exclusion, and it depends on how many beneficiaries inherited the IRA, but take a look at that as well.
Okay. And this question occurred because when I was going through my TurboTax entries and got to the review stage, and after I had entered a second amount of money with the same brokerage firm, the same what looks to me like two different 1099-Rs from the same house, my refund and taxes due amounts jumped right up, higher than they've ever been before. And especially the tax due went up higher than it's ever been before. So that got me suspicious that I might have been double entering something.
It's possible.
If you can view TurboTax to get to the 1040 line 4B, but in general, you need to understand, you need to understand the taxability here.
Okay, Elizabeth, thanks a lot. Good luck. We're joined today by Don Doherty and Judy Cahey from BST. This is from Renee in Albany. I had no taxable income in 2021, so I didn't file. But because of that, I did not get the expanded child tax credit that was around for a short time. Is there something I can file to still get that credit from 2021? That's from Renee in Albany.
You remember that conversation we had at the top of the hour about statute of limitations?
Yeah, yeah, the 3-year. Yeah.
All right.
Yes, so. Yeah. So 2021 return would normally be due by April 15th, 2022. So you have a 3-year statute from that moment in time.
So another whole year to figure it out.
Yes.
All right, fair enough. Let's see. Dave is in Olive Bridge. Dave, you're on.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
About 8 years ago, I started taking a state pension, resigned. And then a couple of years later, I was fully retired and collected my Social Security. And my tax person said, asked me if I wanted to take federal tax holding. And I don't know why, but she suggested I did some amount, and I did $40 per month, and it's been 5 years since then. I just got a letter asking if I still want to take it out, and I took it. I changed it to where I am not going to take it out anymore. Is there any way that I could get any refund from that back?
I'm trying to understand, what is it exactly that they asked you to pay the $40 toward? Was it your federal tax?
It was like
federal tax withholding?
Yes, it was just like a buffer, I guess.
And did you...
Okay,
and did you ask for withholding with whomever was paying on your pension? Is that where it came from your pension?
No, for my Social Security.
For Social Security. Okay, so that should have showed up then.
So when you file your individual return, you should be claiming that withholding.
Correct.
And, you know, the question is, and we're obviously giving a very general answer here, but the question is, do you end up having taxability with your Social Security, and your level of income determines that. So sometimes people need to have some withholdings because they'd rather do that than to write quarterly checks to the government to try to offset the tax. So it really, it depends on if you have taxability at all. And if you do, then whether or not you want to pay quarterly estimates or have withholding. But you can change those numbers.
I understand. Okay. I don't have the taxability, and I don't file anymore.
So how many? So we might be back to our statute of limitations question.
Oh, exactly. That's right.
We're going back to the same topic again. is you have you might be losing a year here. You got to get filing soon on that third year because you have a 3-year window to file. Sometimes 2 years from date paid, but you got to talk to an accountant very fast before you get a statute
chance
lose another year on your withholding.
And really, thanks, Dave. What are the odds you're going to find an accountant this late in the tax year?
Well,
there's a lot of accountants retiring, and there's less and less coming out of college, right? So it taxes is shorthanded.
Why, though? I mean, taxes are never going to go away. This seems to be a bumper industry, right?
Well, I think technology will factor into that in the future, right? The ability we've all seen the H&R Block commercial or whoever the commercial was about, okay, just take a picture of your W-2 and we do your taxes. But it's not quite that simple, but technology will catch up a little bit here on the more basic returns.
That's the skill, but what about the art? You want somebody who can help you maximize the old, you limit your liability,
There's it gets very complex with businesses, and obviously we're talking inheritance tax and a lot of different variables to taxes. So,
all right, let's go to lovely Westchester and Stacy. Stacy, where are you in Westchester?
Hi, I'm in Katona.
Oh, beautiful. All right, you're on. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I called a question about my daughter, but I wanted to quickly follow up first on a response you gave to someone who had just formed the LLC, because I'm in the same boat. I formed an LLC this year, though, 2024, and I was sole proprietor before that. And I thought that when you went to sell your home, that the home office, only counted if it was a separate structure from your house, not inside your home, to qualify to be under that $500,000 capital gains threshold.
No, so the home office piece is really the depreciation of it, and it doesn't take necessarily a separate structure. There is a laundry list of IRS factors to be able to deduct a home office.
Right.
It's the depreciation piece I'm talking about, because if you've used it for business and you've had depreciation, you've gotten an ordinary deduction for that. So they want to be able to recapture that upon the disposition should you have gain.
Okay.
Okay. And the thank you. And
we
the
have
reason
1 minute.
I called was the
Stacy, okay, so you have
my
about
daughter,
a minute.
Okay, my daughter, late 20s, worked in New York City. Filed taxes. Then she left the country to get her master's degree outside the United States. Mm-hmm. And she has a little job with the school, but she's a full-time student. Does she still need to file taxes even though she's not making any income here?
If she's below the normal filing threshold, probably not. But she may want to file if she has an opportunity. If there was any U.S. withholding at all on her earnings, she may want to file just to claim the refund. So we don't get into another one of those situations.
Interesting. Now, there's a different deadline for those overseas, yeah?
There is a different deadline. There's an additional 2 months for people who are overseas in order to file, just to accommodate the fact that post doesn't reach the United States as quickly.
All right, Stacy.
Thank you. Yeah, that's
You're
great.
Welcome.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot for the call. Well, we're done here. Judy Cahey and Dawn Doherty of BST, you've done it again. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Well, you really worked those computers during this show. I tell you what. All right. Well, thank you so much. We'll talk to you soon. Toward the end of the year, we'll do our usual tax strategy session.
Thanks.
Support comes from Troy Savings Bank Music Hall, announcing writer-comedian Ophira Eisenberg with guest Sean Eli Friday, April 5th at 8 p.m., TroyMusicHall.org. Thanks again to Judy Cahey and Dawn Doherty of BST for being with us today. Thank you for calling. Thanks for the emails. Apologies if we didn't get to your question. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Andrea Leon screened the calls. Beautiful job. Thank you, Andrea. And tomorrow on the show, oh boy. Well, you know, I don't know if you know about this, but there's going to be this eclipse coming up early next month, and people are getting pretty excited about it. So we'll have a couple of astronomers on the show to make sure that you enjoy it and you don't go blind. That'll be tomorrow at 2 p.m. We'll see you for that one.